One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, former New York Times columnist, now a fellow at Demos, Bob Herbert, on the real Nelson Mandela. Also on the program today, boom, a trial judge in a D.C. circuit court says the NSA metadata collection program is unconstitutional, then stays his own decision for appeal. Meanwhile, NSA still has no idea what documents Edward Snowden took and are starting maybe slightly to float the idea of amnesty if they tell him what he took. Meanwhile, Governor Chris Christie shrinking, at least in the sense of his integrity and vision of him as a guy who's just above politics. He just gets the job done. Also on the program today, daughters apparently make you more conservative. Why? Well, Ross Dachau gives us a clue, perhaps. Meanwhile, all those, that charity that the wealthy are giving, guess who they're giving it to? Themselves. And a New Hampshire state politician throws down the gauntlet. We got a couple of mass holes in the office right now. Don't appreciate Scott Brown taking any guff from those guys up in New Hampshire. We will discuss as the program continues. And meanwhile, GM, great news on the GM is no more, right? Wasn't there a socialist takeover and GM is disastrous? We will get to their new investments in American jobs in just a bit. First, folks, it's a little housekeeping. We have a new Credo deal. As you know, Credo is sponsoring the program for the rest of this month. As of 2 days ago, on Sunday, they have a new deal. 50% off a new phone. And we've mentioned before, they are not limited to phones like Android phones or Blackberries. They have other phones. Still offering up to a $350 buyout of your existing contract as credit towards your Credo bill. You know all about Credo. They fight for progressive change. They keep wayward Democrats from moving too far to the right. They fight against Tea Partiers. 1% of their revenue goes to progressive nonprofits, and their revenue funds also Credo Action, which is fighting against things like the Keystone XL pipeline, fighting to expand Social Security. Check it out today, credomobile.com/Sam. We've got links, obviously, on the homepage at majority.fm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bob Herbert. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. First, I want to start off by playing a clip of Nelson Mandela. Here he is speaking on the eve of the 2003 invasion and occupation of the Iraq War.
What I'm condemning is that one power with a president who has no foresight, who cannot think properly, is now wanting to plunge the world into a Holocaust as a departure in almost everything that we do. And if there is a country that has committed unspeakable atrocities in the world, it is the United States of America. They don't care.
I want to welcome to the program Bob Herbert. He's a former New York Times columnist and a fellow at Demos. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Good to be here, Sam.
So I wanted to play that clip right off the top because it was not a clip that we saw played a lot as people remembered Nelson Mandela. And I think it speaks to at least part of what you were trying to get at with your piece in the Jacobin. The real Nelson Mandela. Tell us what you were concerned would get lost as people reflected on his life.
Well, you know, I agree. The tendency is to, when a giant like this dies, to turn him into some kind of universal feel-good figure. He stands for all the things that everybody can stand for, all the platitudes. He's almost like a stick figure, a cardboard character. And I thought that the same thing has been done over the decades with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So they're in favor of peace and they're in favor of brotherhood, and you know, who's not in favor of that sort of thing? And you know, the piece that I wrote was to say that while these were certainly not haters and that they were ultimately men of peace, that to just see them in that light is to miss their significance, to miss their historical importance, that these were defiant figures of resistance against terribly evil occurrences, you know, that both in their own way were fighting against racial oppression. Apartheid in South Africa and then terrible segregation and other racial injustices in the United States. And so these were truth tellers. They were firebrands. They were liberators. I wrote that above all, they were warriors. And I thought that that's the way that they should be remembered.
And you know, I think lost too, I think, in is the idea that Nelson Mandela, while I mean, I don't know what the definition of a man of peace is, but he certainly did not renounce violence. I mean, that was central to why he was kept in prison for 27 years.
He absolutely did not renounce violence. He felt that in some cases, and I got the impression in reading the historical record that he saw violence as a last resort, but not the sort of thing that could be taken off the table. And he was, in fact, in charge of the essentially the military wing of the African National Congress. And their stated goal was to use violence if necessary, but to use it against state facilities and to try and minimize human casualties as much as possible. But what they essentially were saying was that violence was an integral part of their strategy going forward, that they were going to do whatever was necessary to bring down apartheid. And that's what I one of the things that I really wanted to emphasize, that with both King and with Nelson Mandela, it wasn't a case of these guys should be remembered as someone who could lock arms with their enemies, who could embrace their foes and bring us to a state of peace and brotherhood in that way. These were guys who were determined to bring the enemy to their knees, to win this to win this fight, to do all the things necessary to succeed. And then when they succeeded in freeing their people or achieving justice for their people, then they could forgive. They weren't about vengeance. They weren't about hatred or reprisals and that sort of thing. But the first order of business was to free the people.
And do you think, that distinction, the notion of that, it's a theory of power that you must defeat this, what you're fighting against, before you can interlock arms on some level. I mean, that is something, that dynamic, there's a particular anathema to that in our society. I mean, and I speak that, you know, with the sort of the limitations on my understanding of other societies, but that seems to be sort of fundamental. I mean, we see that across the board in terms of social movements in this country, that they are. Go ahead.
I agree. I've actually publicly talked a lot about how I'm upset at the absence of militancy that I see in the society on a number of fronts. I mean, if we're talking about economic justice, if we're talking about the continuing racial injustice that occurs in this society, when we're talking about all the various forms of unfairness that are in the society right now, they should be fought against. And they need to be fought against militantly. And by militantly, I don't mean violently. I'm not suggesting that people take up arms or something like that. But short of violence, I think people really do, as you point out, need to take the steps necessary to defeat their enemies, to defeat their foe, to win, to achieve the goals that you've stated for yourself. And, you know, what both you and I are talking about are legitimate goals. We're not talking about trying to bring about a state of affairs that's going to be unfair to other people. We're trying to eradicate injustice. And I agree with you, with the tendency now, and it's a widespread tendency, is to start with the idea of, you know, you're going to reach out and embrace the people who are on the other side as if somehow that's going to magically bring about the ends that you're seeking. And that is, as you pointed out, a misreading of how one goes about achieving power or utilizing power to achieve desired ends.
You know, I mean, it's fascinating because we can see this in just about, I mean, you know, when we look back, for instance, on just sort of on what unions and what labor did in this country, there was a tremendous, I mean, and in some instances there was violence, but there was a tremendous amount of militancy. I mean, what is it, I mean, about, I mean, I wonder, I mean, I imagine obviously in South Africa, the whitewashing can't really take place in the way that it takes place in this country from afar, but we somehow have managed to do it in rather short time when it comes to figures like Martin Luther King. What accounts for that?
I think, I think what happens is some of the things that have gone on and in some cases are still going on are so terrible, so horrible, that people really don't want to think about it. When you have the atrocities in the past, if they're over, then the tendency is to put it out of sight, out of mind. You know, go back into this idea of, you know, hey, it's a wonderful society, justice prevailed. That's really sort of what happens in the United States in any event. And then you don't really have to spend any time immersed in the awful things that occurred. And it allows you at some point to almost believe that they really weren't as horrible as some people have said. You know, why do you keep wallowing in it? But the other thing that happens is it can make you miss the point of what is still occurring. This idea of living in a state of denial can become widespread. So you don't acknowledge the injustices that are still occurring, and you don't acknowledge how you contribute to that injustice by not speaking out or acting to take care of it. I do think that it's sort of a widespread form of societal denial. And I think that it's dangerous, because the other side does not approach these matters that way. The other side is very serious. The other side is very fierce, and the injustices still occur. And a way of looking at it now is to see what's happening with low-wage workers in this economy, to see the way the great corporations have just dumped millions of people out of jobs, just thrown, you know, over the past several years, just thrown millions of people out of jobs without any care of what that does to the individuals or their families or to the economy as a whole. So that sort of thing needs to be fought against, and it needs to be fought against, in my view, furiously.
You know, we're getting a little bit afield from your piece to a certain extent, but as we're talking about this, I mean, I had just read a piece, and for the life of me, I cannot remember who read it, but it was analyzing President Obama's inequality speech from a couple of weeks ago, and noticed that it was all sort of in the passive sense. In other words, that inequality just happened.
Right.
And there was no agency, which is not to suggest that he was responsible necessarily, but this notion of these things just occur and then they just go away on some level. And it also reminds me of when President Obama came into office and said we need to turn the page on things like on Iraq and
exactly.
on torture. I mean, these are all this is all sort of part of that societal tick that we have in some way.
Exactly. It's almost like pretending that stuff never happened or that stuff is over. When you talk about this inequality that is plaguing the country now, as you noted, it didn't just happen. These were all policy decisions over the past 30 or 40 years that were designed to, and it's a term that you're not even supposed to use, you know, redistribution of the wealth, but this was designed to redistribute wealth from the middle classes and lower income people to the top. And those policy choices have worked remarkably well, which is why, you know, we're so top heavy with the wealth in this country. And now if people come along and they want to correct this sort of imbalance, that they want a more fair distribution of wealth and income, the argument is that you're fomenting class warfare. So you're not even allowed to talk about redistribution of wealth if what you mean is to redistribute some of it from the top down. But the reality is that nearly all the wealth in this country over the past 40 years has been redistributed from the middle and the bottom up.
And one thing in terms of another parallel between Mandela and King is the, I guess, the downplaying or the de-emphasis on their a broader perspective on social justice. I mean, you know, which is part of the reason why I wanted to play that clip of Mandela prior to Iraq. But it also, I'm also thinking in terms of economic justice, that part of their legacies, in many respects, you know, and obviously for different reasons, maybe between Mandela and King, has also been very much, I guess, sort of shuffled down the rabbit hole.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it's why it was so appropriate to begin this segment with that clip. And as I was listening to it, it made me think of Dr. King when he spoke out in 1967 against the Vietnam War and declared that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And at the time, he was widely denounced for that speech and for those comments. And even the New York Times took him to task in an editorial. The headline on the editorial was Dr. King's Error. So when they were talking, you know, you talk about the justice that's denied as a result of violence and warfare, and then, of course, the economic justice. I mean, people have tended to forget that the March on Washington was a march for jobs and freedom. I mean, that was the title of the march. Everybody tends to think of it as, you know, a march for civil rights. And then you can say, well, we don't have segregation in this country, or you don't have legal segregation anymore, so the civil rights movement won. But we still don't have economic justice in this country, and you still don't have economic justice in South Africa. So these are ongoing fights, and you undermine those struggles when you sort of take the militancy of great figures like Dr. King and Mandela off the board. So then they don't serve as the kind of, in my view, the kind of inspiration that they should be known for.
They should be
figures of inspiration for people today who are militantly fighting against injustice.
And that's part of the, I mean, that's not necessarily a coincidence. I mean, maybe that's even an understatement.
I agree with you. It's not a coincidence.
And what's interesting too is that Mandela never really was able did not have the success, or I don't know even if it's even fair to say necessarily that he jettisoned that part of the agenda upon sort of the racial emancipation in South Africa. But it's almost as if, like, you know, that's just one bridge too far, you know?
You know, that's really interesting, and it's something that I've thought a lot about and actually sort of struggled with intellectually. I just think that after a while, because I think it applies to Dr. King as well as Nelson Mandela, after a while, you can almost ask too much of an individual, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important to have them serve as inspirations, so that what you want is to develop leaders for an ongoing struggle, because all of this stuff takes a really long time. It takes decades. I mean, look how long, if you go back to the early days of the labor movement, look how long it took to get reasonable success for workers in this country, which, by the way, those successes are being rolled back now. So there's only so much, I guess, that an individual can do. And when you have these movements, the civil rights movement, which I've studied intensely in this country, they didn't really create a cadre of leaders to follow after the great leaders of the 1950s and 60s, to follow after King and his colleagues. And I do think that you can lose ground, or you can achieve some of your goals, but not all of your goals. It's very difficult to sustain.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, part of that, I think, is that you don't have the resources to create institutions that can outlive the individual leaders and outlive them, you know, beyond the past, where they have a certain amount of energy as well. I mean,
I think that's a really good point, and therefore it's a point that folks who care about economic justice, racial justice, justice of all kinds, should be paying closer attention to. How do you begin to establish those kinds of institutions? I think that's really important, because I think that if you look at what conditions are in the United States, and they're certainly not limited to black people in the United States. I mean, there are so many people who are struggling now economically and socially, that we're going to need another broad-based movement comparable to the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. And so you look to those movements and you say, well, where did they come up short? Or, you know, where could they have done better? And your point about creating these kinds of institutions that can sustain a movement is really an important point, and I think people ought to be looking closely at that.
And do you think, I mean, you know, because this is something that is also, you know, I've been obviously the past couple of years been sort of contemplating this notion of, you know, in this country, the at least, you know, in the context of the Democratic Party, there was this cleave that occurred in the late 60s between sort of the economic populist parts of the Democratic Party and the social emancipation movements. And for a long time, these were at odds with each other, at least, you know, in some areas. I mean, you know, supposedly creating, to the extent that it's mythological or real, but the Reagan Democrats, if you will. And on some level that, you know, now that we are, if not, obviously we haven't completed the sort of social emancipation projects that were started in the 60s, but in some ways, there's been just a tremendous amount of progress, and that particularly you can see this in the younger generations who, you know, the ideas of their grandparents just seem completely just as foreign. I mean, as foreign as they could be in many respects. I mean, do you think that we are on the precipice of, you know, as we see this generation getting older and are no longer able to be sort of the wedge issues of race and of gender and of sexual orientation don't have the same efficacy as they had, you know, in the case of sexual orientation? You know, this has been an unbelievable flip, at least in terms of a political cudgel, you know, from where it was 10 years ago.
The wedges issues just don't have the clout that they once had. They once were spectacularly successful. And when you talk about injustice, and I've run into this a lot, you have to be really careful because you're talking about injustices that are still occurring in many cases, really terrible injustices, and you want to fight strongly against them. But it is a mistake if you don't acknowledge how far we've come over the past half century or so, and in many cases just in the past 20 or 30 years. I'm old enough now, when I look at where this country was when I was a young man and where we are now, and it's just night and day in terms of attitudes, in terms of opportunities, just in many ways. I've often said publicly that my father, who was a very smart man, he could not have had any of the jobs that I had in my entire career, and that's because he was black, he just never would have been permitted to have those jobs. So he couldn't have been a reporter at the Star Ledger or at the Daily News. He couldn't have been a correspondent for NBC. He couldn't have been a columnist for the New York Times. And that's just in one generation. So in one generation, we've made enough progress that I was able to have that kind of a career that I was able to have. You mentioned what's happened with gays. So I was in school in the 1950s and 60s, and the idea that you could, forget the reality of gay marriage, for example, the idea that you could even have a conversation about gays getting married would have just staggered the imagination. You wouldn't have been able to believe it. You would think, who would talk about that? You know, not even in public. No one was even talking about that in private, unless you were gay or you had a close relationship with someone who was gay. So we've made astonishing progress over the past several decades, but it's a measure of how deep some of the injustices are that we still have so much terrain still to travel.
Right. I mean, I wonder, you know, if we're starting to see some of these sort of as these wedge issues lose their potency, and again, this is not to say that these are still not contentious and that they've been resolved, but in sort of like broader political terms. I mean, even, you know, the most interesting developments, I think, you know, from the 2012 election was that we're starting to see Democrats and the left come out from the other side of trying to hold hands on the questions of choice, you know, where there has been more of a full-throated defense for women to be full people in our society, which I think is a big change again over the past 10, 15 years.
I agree. I was waiting anxiously for this to emerge. It seemed to me that it was taking the longest time for this to develop.
And now that you know, I mean, it starts to bring about this sort of tension of like, what is going to be the defining, you know, the battle? I mean, getting back to Mandela at this point, when we talk about, you know, vanquishing the enemies, on some level, it's a question of really starting to name those enemies in some way that is not, I guess, obscured by sort of the social emancipation fights. I mean, because we now know who the enemies are in those fights, and we know where the battle lines are, and it's all, if it's not, those projects are not finished, at least the battle lines are clear. And it still seems to be ill-defined in the context of economic justice in this country.
I think that's true. But what I think is going to be the, I think economic justice is going to be the defining issue going forward, even though there are other very important issues, and there's still important racial justice issues and that sort of thing out there. But I think that because so many people are struggling economically, and we see the protests and the strikes by low-wage workers and that sort of thing, but I've also seen kids coming out of college with four-year degrees, coming out of terrific colleges and universities, who are unable to find full-time work or unable to find work that actually required a college degree. They have these college loans weighing them down, and it's becoming more and more difficult for young people, even with a decent education, to establish a mature adult quality of life, where you can get married if you want to, and begin to have a family and make that first down payment on a home. And I think that looking around, people are just going to see, wow, there's more and more people in this same boat. And I do think that that's going to be the defining issue going forward. You know, you need leaders to emerge. You need decent thinkers who can formulate strategies and tactics going forward. But I think that it's going to become such a compelling issue. And I actually think in some cases the pain is just going to be so great that people are going to say, hey, you know, we really have to rise up and do something.
So lastly, I mean, if from your perspective, I mean, do you have a favorite book or speech or something that people you would recommend if they wanted to go back to get to capture the essence of Nelson Mandela in a way that is not as sort of, I guess, glossed over? What would you suggest for folks?
Oh, I think his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, which a fair number of people know about, but a lot fewer people actually read, lays out the struggle and his view and his efforts and those of the people in the fight with him. I think that's a terrific starting point. But also along those lines, and Dr. King almost has become like a cliche. You know, you say Martin Luther King, and everybody has this image of Martin Luther King. One of the things is that he always seems older than he actually was. He was only 39 when he was killed. But what we've missed the lesson of Dr. King, and I would really recommend that people go back and read about his life. There have been two or three really terrific biographies out there, but also read Dr. King's own writings, and you'll see the richness in there. That, of course, there was the racial struggle and the fight for civil rights, but he was so clear about the idea that the racial struggle was entwined with a struggle for economic rights, that and that economic rights crossed racial lines, that you needed economic justice and you needed to bring people out of poverty no matter where they were or who they were. And then when he would sort of counsel that you can't make the kind of progress we need to make here at home if we're going to have these foreign wars, these foreign adventures that make no sense and that are so tragic in their ultimate outcomes and that devour so many of the resources that are needed here at home. King was all over all of that stuff. And then beyond that, he understood the importance and how to go about direct action to begin to counter the forces on the other side. So, I mean, there's just a richness to this man's young life and thinking that's amazing and that still talks to me today. And I think if people would go back and look at Dr. King's life in a serious way, they'll be surprised at how appropriate everything he was dealing with is to our state of affairs today.
Bob Herbert, thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Sam. Great to talk with you.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half in just a moment. I want to read an email. Always a pleasure to speak to Bob Herbert. I don't think we've had him on since the old Majority Report days with Janine and I.
I'm a huge Bob Herbert fan.
Huge.
Huge.
Huge. All right, I want to read a couple of emails. It is, we got, as you know, this week will be our final week for 2013.
Live-wise,
yes. We're going to be playing Best Ofs for the last week of 2013. We will be back towards the end of the first week of 2014. If you have any late entrees into what you think should be included in our best of the year, by all means, we had one listener actually put together the Where's Hugo run, which included that fateful interview with John Benjamin.
Hey, if anyone else wants to do that and help me out, by all means.
I haven't spoken to John Benjamin since then. We had a massive falling out after that. We've had dinner since, but we don't talk.
Is that why Hugo hasn't been in Bob's Burgers for God knows how long?
That is part of the that's probably part of it. Benjamin and I still will eat out, but we will not talk during the meal. We eat in silence. And it's very awkward. And then we have a weird...
How do you guys arrange that then? Is that when you talk for like a second?
No, we have our people.
Oh, okay.
We have our people, you know, make the arrangements. We both show up at the restaurant. We bring our families. And then when it's time to pay the bill, we just both keep pointing to each other's wallet. And that's how we argue over who's going to cover it. So it's a little bit awkward, but if you have any other suggestions, whether they are Friday segments or whether they are interviews or if there were particular moments where perhaps Michael said something funny or Matt said something funny, if you can recall that. I know some people mark that off in their diaries when that
Matt
happens.
Says something funny.
Right, or when Michael says something funny.
Matt says something funny.
So just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. On Friday, we're going to have Isabel and Film Guy Matthew for a final send-off for the year.
Maybe like a best movie of 2013 pick from each of them?
It could be that. It could be that. I'm not sure. We haven't worked out the details, and I'm sure we won't. We'll just we'll do it like 5 minutes beforehand, and then they'll deal with it. I want to read this email. I've been with Credo. We got to turn off that heat now because now it's starting to smell.
All right, sure.
We have some type of like toxic... I should say that
we're slowly poisoning ourselves.
Yes, it's just capping off the week where my family had lice and strep throat. It was all. We've had quite a week at the Cedar household.
Ew.
Yeah. Listener Dave writes, FYI, I've been with Credo for a few years now, and on top of Credo Action and all that, what makes them great is their customer service. All these stupid stupid ass smartphones break after a while, or something F's up no matter what who you're with, but Credo's great about troubleshooting, if necessary, replacing defective equipment. Trey writes, I got my Credo Mobile buyout credit and will not have a cell phone bill till February of 2014. That means President Obama birth certificate trays for all. I didn't know you could get that. Hi, Sam and crew. This is coming from Larry. I'm a member. Thank you. And I want to thank you for setting up the Credo Mobile discount deal. Today, I ordered up a not to be identified, but very shiny smartphone with them. Now, for the first time in over a decade, I finally won't be shoveling money to either of the two biggest immoral corporations of the cell phone industry. It grated on my soul every month, I swear. Instead, a bit of that cash will actually be going doing some good. So don't forget, credomobile.com/Sam. 50% off of one of those shiny new phones and up to $350 credit on your Credo bill as a buyout. You can also support this program by becoming a member. I'm actually doing the year-end books. The past couple of months were a little bit sad. Our member revenue was actually down. I don't know how that happened, but if you can become a year over year, I should say. If you can become a member, if you have the financial means, please do to support the program. If you can't, if you don't have the means, but you want access to the bonus material every day, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We work out a deal with everyone. We will not bar anybody because of finances.
If you want to become a member, there's no reason why you shouldn't be a member.
There you go. And you can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. Buy it through our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Buy all your crap through there. We get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. That's what you should be doing, spending your vacation, if you have one, for Christmas. Just, you know, getting drunk if you need to deal with the family and you can't, and then you're still drinking. But then just go on iTunes and give us a great review on the app and the podcast. It makes a difference in terms of the rankings.
And if you don't have a vacation, there's no reason why you can't do it while you're at work.
That's right, because... nobody's calling you, or, you know, it's slow time at work. All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be part of the program, 646-257-3920. You want to IM me, you can IM me through the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com, or you can IM me through AIM at Majority Reporter or Majority FM. See you in a bit.